It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser along with Tim Stenovec live at the Milken Institute Global Conference here on the West Coast. And, you know, what's interesting is we did talk with Mark Jenkins, head of Global Credit Carlyle Group earlier, big players in the credit markets, and he talked about making credit, right, private, you name it, more accessible to investors. And our next guest is working on making alternative asset classes more accessible as well.
Matt Brown is the founder and CEO of Case. He joins us here at the Milken Institute Global Conference. Matt, it's really great to have you on the show. You've been really busy over the last couple of days.
Yeah, it's been a great couple of days. This theme of democratizing finance has really been a big front and center topic for the conference.
Well, take us into your panel yesterday, because you moderated a panel with people like Gene Case, Kathy Wood, Carol, who you're speaking to, in just a couple hours?
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah,
what were some big takeaways from what you learned?
You know, I think the real big theme there was, you know, inclusion. Making sure that we have a financial system that actually allows all participants. It was about decentralization. It was about removing the intermediaries like big banks and brokerage firms and allowing participants to have direct interaction with each other to reduce cost and efficiency and increase efficiency. But overall, it was a fascinating conversation. Kathy Wood really dug into kind of democratizing access for individual investors, young investors, the millennials. We're just living in a whole different world than I grew up in.
You know, it's interesting. I just got off a panel talking with heads in the M&A world and some of your established players, whether it's a Deutsche Bank or a Citigroup, and talking about fintech and the upstarts, you know, and obviously they're talking their book a little bit, but the idea that, you know, there's incredible regulatory oversight over the investment space, and many would say that that's necessary to make sure that investors aren't unduly, or folks who tap the financial system, right, that they are protected. So how do the upstarts, how are they, because I think there's a feeling that the regulatory environment isn't keeping up with it, and maybe understand the risks or the benefits.
Yeah, there's a big feeling, right, around that. Just to take a step back, you know, 30 years ago, especially around alternative investments or private funds or private credit, the SEC and the government's position was that, you know, you have to be wealthy enough that you can lose some money in these types of investments.
An accredited investor.
And as a result, what they effectively did was exclude a huge population of, you know, the U.S. and internationally from participating in alternative investments. What's happening today is, I think there's been a relook at that. And mm-hmm. they're realizing now that alternative investments, including private credit, as you mentioned, are doing their job. They have a role in a portfolio, and done the right way, they can really preserve and grow wealth over time. And to exclude and not allow the democratization of these types of investments is not the right idea.
How do you do that in the right way, though? What do regulators need to do in order to make sure that if people who can't afford to lose money aren't excluded from these alternative asset classes?
It's really coming down to certification, education, scalable education. FinTech, as we think about, oftentimes does allow access to financial products, but FinTech can bring a lot of different things in a scalable format, the most of which can be education. So really, you can't talk about democratizing access to investments unless you're talking about educating a broad group of new participants who are going to be making investments, so they're going in with open eyes. You look at Robinhood and some of the, you know, Reddit, some of the kind of the concern there is the gamification of these platforms, and maybe not everyone knows exactly what's going on and can they lose too much money. So you're going to see a real rise of education as kind of a cornerstone in this.
There's education. In other words, you can go on a website and read some stuff. You know, it's very passive. But does it need to be something that's much more formal so that you've got to pass some form of a financial literacy test? That
like
you,
a driver's test?
Well, to some extent, so that you really know you're talking about your welfare, your investments, your money that you might need to, you know, live on.
So the SEC right now is currently amended the accreditation rule to include a new lane for education. And the way they're determining that is based on your profession, your experience, your licenses in the finance industry. So they're already moving away from net worth as just the only criteria. And now they're saying, you know what, if you're smart enough and you can certify that, then you should be able to participate. So that's that first step in removing a net worth requirement. But you're right. It's actually about making sure you can prove that the work has been done.
Right.
Is there any concern that there could be, I don't know, people getting around these guardrails and some ugly situations that cause regulators to think differently about this? Well, I think back to all the issues with Robinhood.
I think of Elizabeth Warren. Wait a minute.
What regulators are doing around Robinhood right now.
Yeah. It is a concern. And so our company hasn't reached out to the end investor. We're a B2B platform. So our client who uses our platform to access alternative investments is a financial advisor, professional investor.
An RIA,
exactly. So we do have our concerns as well. So we're watching it very closely, watching what the government's doing. We want to be part of the solution.
Right.
On that.
And I do wonder if it's some of these alt investments, is it a case if it's a fund, you're getting a piece of it, right? So that you're not all in and that you reduce some of your risk.
Yeah, it's a diversified pool.
Right.
But liquidity is a big point as well. I know we're kind of out of time here, but, you know, are you locking your capital up for a month, a week, or 5 years, or 10? So.
But you think about if universities and endowments want to be able to tap these alt investments, because in the search for yield, but they've also got to make sure that those endowments are there for the future, you have to wonder about opening up to a wider pool of investors,
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
That's basically what we're talking about. Hey, Matt Brown, thank you.
Hey, thank you very much.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We want to talk a little bit about SPACs because they've had their ups, they've had their downs this year, no doubt about it. And we have a great guest to talk about.
Orlando Bravo is founder and a managing partner at Thoma Bravo. He's with us at the Milken Institute Global Conference right now. First of all, how's your conference going? I mean, we talked a lot about yesterday how it really feels like things are kind of getting back to normal, albeit with masks on.
Well, first, thanks so much for having me. The conference is awesome. Think about it. We're here in L.A. A lot of it is outside. The weather's perfect. I've gotten to see some of our limited partners that I hadn't seen in 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
So some of the old friends, and also meet a lot of new people. So it's just been great. One meeting after the other, right? 15-minute meetings and then trying to see as many people
face-to-face,
as we can.
Face-to-face, like, it's remarkable, right?
Unbelievable.
So what? Okay, let's talk about SPACs. Because I was looking at some of the indexes. They're down as a group about 10% so far this year. They're down about 30% if you look at certain indexes from the mid-February high. Where are we? Because people are talking about the death of SPACs. And as Tim mentioned earlier, I mean, these are cycles that things go through. SPACs are not a new investment vehicle.
Exactly. SPACs are going to come back. They are. They've been around for, 25 or 30 years. But why do we think that there was this incredible craze to SPACs? It's because technology companies, there's so much innovation and so much new business creation and so many tech companies being formed that are getting to scale that the financial markets are trying to adapt of how can we absorb all these new assets into the market.
Because we're not seeing a lot of IP. I mean, we saw the IPO market fall off a little bit, right?
It did, and now it's back.
Now it's back. But I'm just saying that, you know, that there's alternatives for going public here.
And the alternatives are great. Direct listings are great. And the SPAC provides a great alternative because what it really, really does is it allows a company to be able to openly talk about its projections
right.
with its investors. Every investor, think about it, if you're looking to buy a company, if we are together going to buy a private company, wouldn't we like to sit down with management and say, let's see what you've done in the past and how do you think about next year and the following year? And how does your operating plan and strategic plan align with that financial plan that you have? It gives you so much insight mm-hmm. as to how management thinks about their own business.
But are you concerned at all that there is a lack of quality companies to be acquired by SPACs that are out there looking for targets right now?
I'm always concerned about quality. What ended up happening as well with this SPAC boom is a number of companies went public through SPACs or merged with SPACs that are venture capital companies, mm-hmm. that are really young companies. Now, retail investors in particular participated in that because the regulatory environment doesn't allow them to participate in venture capital and private equity.
Right.
So they rush to this market. And then the regulators get worried that, oh, they're going to lose money, or these companies have lack of a track record, or they're going to miss their numbers. Now, we'll see what ultimately happens. But one of the things you said at the beginning is SPACs are out of favor now. Of course, nobody likes SPACs. But the trading should be the underlying company.
Correct.
Forget of whether it was a SPAC or IPO or direct listing. It's what matters is the underlying business.
And is that what happened, though, Orlando, in your view, that we got a little sloppy in terms of looking at the underlying fundamentals, the basics of like understanding the business and the growth trajectory?
Absolutely. It takes about 9 months for a de-SPAC to begin trading on its own merits mm-hmm. versus from the fact that it was a SPAC to begin with. And that's an inefficiency in the market that shouldn't exist.
But is there something that the industry needs to get? I just came through a panel of folks in the M&A world and saying, you know, we'll get through this, okay? But, and just got about 40 seconds left here, but we need to, as an industry, get together and maybe set some rules, some understandings of what a SPAC needs to be.
I give you two great rules that we should have.
In 40 seconds.
One is transparency.
Yeah.
So the SPAC should be able to post, these are my projections or our projections, and every quarter compare to how you were doing.
Right.
Every quarter. Just show that in the front page or show that in your communications. And the other one is alignment. Bring the best of private equity to SPACs, which is the sponsor has to invest significant capital in that pipe.
So some skin in the game.
Absolutely.
All right. That would certainly be a game changer. Orlando, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We scratched the surface, but so hopefully we can continue in the future. Orlando Bravo, founder and managing partner of Thoma Bravo, joining us here at Milken.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes. 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com. Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Can I just tell you, you know, at Milken yesterday, I hosted a panel, and it was all about the role of technology and longevity. We're talking about aging. One of the panelists studies the brain. We talked a lot about what happens as we age and what we can do about it.
You got to tell the panelists about Sarah McBride's next story.
I am totally. It's in the special double issue. It's the persuasion issue at Bloomberg Business Week. So let's get to it.
Let's get to it with Sarah McBride, venture capital reporter at Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Sarah's story, what a brain scan reveals about the science of persuasion. It's in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which Carol mentioned is the persuasion issue. Sarah, neuroscientists have come a long way in understanding how and when people come around to a different point of view. So what exactly happens to our brain when we change our mind?
Okay, well, they have come a long way, but there's still a long way to go. It sounds like that particular area of study is really tricky for neuroscientists, and that's because other things we do are more localized to one or just a few parts of the brain. For example, if you move a limb, whereas something that requires thought, like persuasion, is spread out across so many parts of the brain, it's actually much harder to understand exactly what's going on. And this was a lesson in brain science and anatomy for me. I had to learn about all these different parts of the brain that get involved. And they're asking really interesting questions, like if you're analyzing something, how do you separate those neurons to the neurons you use in memory, like when you're trying to remember what you analyzed previously or what your previous opinion was? And they scanned my brain, which was fascinating, and they're looking at areas like the ventromedial prefrontal cortex and the central striatum and all these things, which are kind of spread out in different areas across the brain and reflect persuasion.
Go ahead, Joel. Come on in. Joel Weber's with us, Bloomberg Business Week editor, back in New York.
Sarah, I just have to thank you for lending us your brain and actually letting us even publish a photo of your brain. So what was the whole process like?
So different.
What was the whole process like to have your brain scanned for the purposes of persuasion?
Science. So I'd never done anything like this, and I was hoping that they would have something very interesting to say about my brain, but they were like, yeah, it's very similar to the 45 other brains we looked at for this study.
Hey, come on. That's my brain you're talking about.
Your brain is special.
Right. So I had to get in this fMRI. I don't know if you've ever done that before, but it's just a weird experience. You're in this big cylinder. It's very noisy. You can't really move a whole lot in there. My head was kind of strapped in. They even gave me a little alarm unless I suddenly got claustrophobic and needed to come out. But they kind of arranged these mirrors and screens so that I had the sensation of having more room in there than was actually the case. And then, believe it or not, I just got to watch cartoons.
Sounds like the greatest assignment ever.
Careful, you're talking to your boss here.
So as you're watching cartoons, like let's kind of get to the point where this becomes a business story again.
What cartoons?
What are the potential takeaways for the frontier of this research and what it means for where persuasion and business could go?
Yeah, so they wanted me to watch normalized behavior, which was why they were watching screening cartoons, where things like being unhealthy or not taking care of the environment were just standard in the cartoon. And then they showed me persuasive messages to see if I just kind of been shown the opposite, what would my brain be doing when I was now shown, okay, you should exercise or you should recycle. So the implications for this are pretty big for anybody trying to sell somebody something or a politician trying to get somebody to vote for them. So there's actually millions of dollars being invested in this science. And the hope is that we'll kind of know exactly what parts of the brain are affected when you're persuaded, which means not only will people be able to better persuade you, but the general public will also have a better idea of what's going on too. The science will kind of build up on both sides. Just, so it sounds a little
just think about marketers,
scary.
Right? Like sales and marketing. Like, just think about exploding this.
That's my question for you, Sarah. And I'm wondering, when you reported this story, when you went through this experience, if it makes you think differently about the way that you see advertisements, the way that people try to sell you something. I mean, are you taking do you have a different way of thinking about that now?
Oh God, I've always been so susceptible to advertising. It's ridiculous. now I do kind of think about it, like what little things they might be tweaking. And I hadn't devoted much thought to this idea of your social conditioning and what happens if people all around you think one thing, you know, how much harder it is to change your mind about that. And then there are very fascinating things they're studying, like what happens if you're pretending to agree with something, whereas deep down, you don't really, but you want the social credibility that goes along with agreeing with your friends. So there are so many layers of this. It's really nuanced and fascinating.
You know, Sarah, I just wanted to say, when I saw your brain, I was like, that looks like someone who's very perceptible to persuasive sales pitches. This is like, oh.
She's watching a lot of Home Shopping at night
and also
ordering.
Cartoons.
No, like show me an ice cream cone and I'll immediately think, oh my gosh, that looks delicious.
So how much more research do we expect to be done before this might enter the next phases of applications?
Well, it's one of these things where they've made tremendous strides, but then it's just kind of showing them how much farther they have to go. So each piece of information they gain is just one more step, but advertising is constantly being tweaked based on what we know and what people think they know about the brain. So I think elements of it will be reflected in advertising and marketing in just a few years, and it'll get better and better the deeper they can go into the brain and the more they learn about it. So I'd say 5 to 10 years.
I wonder if Joel walked in, would they make him watch like The Squid Game or something?
Oh, God. I can't think of a worse thing to do than put me in an MRI machine and make me watch a Squid Game. Like, no,
this
no
is your brain on yeah. Squid Game.
I'd be pushing that button to get me out of there as quickly as possible.
All I know is I want those images. All right, guys, we got to run. Venture capital reporter at Bloomberg News, Sarah McBride. Check out her story, What a Brain Scan Reveals About the Science of Persuasion. This is fascinating. She, of course, was joining us with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Webb. That's in the current special double issue, the Persuasion issue of Businessweek magazine.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic. From Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the stock is up nearly 2,000% this year. The company's CEO is known to retail investors as the Silverback because they are the apes. We are talking none other than Adam Aron. He's the chairman and CEO of AMC Entertainment. He joins us now here at the Milken Institute Global Conference. Adam, it's good to see you. It's been a long time.
Tim, nice to see you again.
How are you?
I'm great. You know, if you had told me, I've run AMC now for almost 6 years. And the company that I joined was the second largest movie theater chain in the United States. A year and a half later, it was the largest movie theater chain in the world. Everything was just happening just fine. And if you told me in February of 2020 that we would somehow relive as people on this planet the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918 and 1919, I just couldn't have imagined in this era of modern medicine that we would, in our near term, go through the last year and a half of disease and lockdown and mask wearing. And just think about all the loss and pain that has been suffered on this planet. Everyone has financially sacrificed. Everyone has been overloaded with stress, except the people who work at Clorox. Their business is really booming. Nice people, though. They helped us with our safe and clean protocols at AMC theaters. And many people got sick and many people died, but that's only part of it. And that was the story of 2020, where AMC did everything in our power to avert financial collapse. But we did. We raised billions of dollars in the equity and debt markets, got incredible assistance from our theater landlords and our lenders, and we entered 2021 knowing that we could survive this pandemic no matter what came. Then, what we would never have predicted was that retail investors would descend on AMC the way they have this year. And so, yeah, it's been a fascinating 2 years, needless to say.
They certainly have descended on AMC, and you announced earlier this year a program for retail investors, free popcorn, a platform for them on the website. It does, though, seem like they're losing a little bit of momentum. The folks at Vanda Research said that retail traders have bought less than $16 million in AMC stock over the past week, compared to $600 million at the height of things earlier this year. What are you working on to continue to connect with retail investors?
Well, I have no sense of whether they're picking up steam or losing steam through the research tools that you're talking about. But I do know that I tweet every single day, almost every day. I take a day off every once in a while from my Twitter feed.
It's healthy.
But I started tweeting in earnest in April. And every single day, my Twitter followers increase. I'm at 190,000 this morning. My average tweet is read 1.1 million times. My tweets since April have been read cumulatively 130 million times. Just 3 or 4 weeks ago, I put out a tweet that had my all-time highest readership at almost 6.5 million people read one of my tweets.
Are unwarranted celebrity? Like, are you? I mean, you become a celebrity of sorts, especially on social.
Nah.
Well, your company and your stock certainly have been. What is it about the business that justifies the run up that we've seen in the price? Because I'm looking at it in terms of, you know, your market cap. You're well over $20 billion at this point, roughly five times the value it was if you go back to 2017. That's when we saw the industry and economy much, much better place. So how do you actually deliver on the growth expectations there? Those are high expectations. That's pressure.
So the answer to your question is that back in June, I think it was, when we were raising money yet again, we put out a very important disclosure. So important that the Wall Street Journal carried it on page one above the fold in a banner headline.
Right.
Where we cautioned investors that we were trading away from historic fundamentals and that something entirely different was going on at AMC. And I don't think you drive a car by looking in the rearview mirror only. And so you drive a car by looking through the windshield and looking what's ahead.
Right.
And our goal at AMC is not just to bring back from this pandemic the company that existed in 2019. Mm-hmm. And our shareholders, thankfully, have armed us with what at the end of the June quarter was a more than a $2 billion war chest of cash in the bank or undrawn revolving credit line to put to work to fundamentally transform the company. And that's what we're engaged in right now. In addition to bringing back the company of old, because, mm-hmm. look, there's some really good news for AMC, the movie theater company. And yet we have a way to go. So the really good news is that if you look at the period of October 1 to 14, the first 2 weeks of this month,
yeah,
it was the biggest 14 days of industry box office, which is the basic measure of the health of our industry, this, you know, what the revenues are, was the biggest 14-day box office since February of 2020, since the pandemic started and forced the closure of theaters. It took a long time, it took 20 months, but finally we got the highest box office in over a year and a half. Now, we're still not at 2019 levels,
right,
but if you compare the box office so far in October to the box office in the third quarter, or the box office in the second quarter, or the box office in the first quarter, or the box office last year, you can see this enormous progress we're making. Now, that's
Hang on a second, because we have to do a commercial break, but we're going to come back and do some more.
Sure.
Yeah. One thing I want to talk about is if we ever, yes or no, do we ever get back to pre-pandemic levels, 2019 levels?
In my judgment, yes, but the question is when?
When do you think?
We're not in the business of making predictions. We're in the business of trying to make it happen as soon as we possibly can make it happen.
Adam, you referred to the war chest that you have at AMC Entertainment right now. What are you doing in order to transform the theater experience to get people back into the theaters, especially at a time when they're saying, wait a second, I can just watch this on streaming in a couple weeks?
Well, we have two challenges as a company. First, we have to continue to innovate at our theaters and so that we get more moviegoers and more theatergoers coming to our theaters. This is something AMC's pretty good at. We've been the innovator in our industry for many years now. And some of the things that we've just done in the last few months, we started showing professional sporting events. We are showing professional football on Sunday afternoons, for example. We've had some UFC fights, some WWE matches. We had a big professional boxing fight the other night. In addition, we've been showing some live concerts or some concert movies, both.
Does it move the needle?
People go to them and they enjoy it. But we've got to do something that's much bigger than just continue to innovate at our theaters.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if all we do is innovate at our theaters, we're going to bring back post-pandemic the company that existed in 2019.
Right.
And well, as you said in your build-up in the last segment, the market cap of that company wasn't $20 billion. So our next challenge is to transform the entire company, not just transform the theatrical experience. And in that, you're correct. We ended the second quarter with more than $2 billion of cash and undrawn revolving credit line. We're going to do something with that war chest and add lines of business
right.
that are related to our expertise, but not necessarily being a pure movie theater play.
Adam, in 20 seconds, you said you recently said that you'd accept crypto, including Dogecoin, Bitcoin, Litecoin, and more. Are people buying tickets in crypto?
They are. Right now, they're buying gift cards in crypto. But in a few weeks' time, we'll actually be able to take cryptocurrency for online purchases of AMC tickets and AMC movie concessions at our theaters.
All right, we got to run. Adam, cool. Come back. We'd love to talk more. Adam Aron over at AMC Entertainment. This is Bloomberg.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stiefel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stiefel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stiefel.com. That's Stiefel.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So we talked a lot about sustainable investing yesterday and all of the money going into it, but I'm really looking forward to this next guest. We were just talking before we got going because there is ESG and then there's impact investing, and this is something that's certainly in her world. Joining us right now is Joanna Reese. She's co-lead, of impact investing at Apollo Global Management with us on site at Milken. Nice to have you here on Bloomberg.
Thank you so much for having me.
We did start talking, and I like threw out something about ESG, and you're like, well, wait a minute, Carol. There's a difference between ESG and impact. So talk to us about that, because it does get used, I think, sometimes interchangeably.
Yes. The terms definitely run into each other, and everyone has their own set of terms.
Yeah.
So how we think,
which is part of the problem, right?
Which is part of the problem, but we'll get there.
Okay.
So ESG has been around for a long time. We at Apollo just issued our 12th annual ESG report, so it's a big focus.
Right.
On the part of our firm, really on the part of any alternative asset manager and any asset manager overall. And we think of that as the ownership practices of the company. You know, being mindful of the environmental, social, and governance factors associated with a specific business, measure them, get better, understand what's unique to what the company you own. So that is relevant to any type of company,
right?
And any type of ownership. So you would focus on ESG whether you were looking at, you know, a green energy type player, as well as if you were looking at something that was on the far end, on the other side.
Like an oil company?
You won't say it, but I'll say it. Coal company.
Indeed.
We're there for you.
You can still focus on ESG. If you run a coal mine, you can still get better.
Is that troubling to you, though?
Not at all, because I think we need to, as asset owners, engage with the companies that are where they are today. But that is separate and apart from what we're looking to do on the impact side, which is building upon that foundation.
Mm-hmm.
The data points are astonishing just coming out of Apollo. Our last report has data on 57 companies that have 300,000 employees across their employee base. So it's a huge effort.
Right.
But what we're doing in impact is related in the sense that we still need to be focused on ESG. We still need to report on it, get better at it. But impact is investing in companies where their goods or services improve the world, either mm-hmm. socially or environmentally, directly. So it's not just that they donate to the local charity. It's not just that they have great governance practices. It's that what they do for a living makes the world a better place.
So give us an example.
So the first investment we made on our platform is a company in the circular economy. The company is called Reno de' Medici. Mm-hmm. They manufacture recycled carton board in Europe. So, you know, that's a very clear sustainability story where by the company recycling those fibers, they can be used 7 times. It's so much better environmentally than either using virgin fibers or using, you know, God forbid, like plastic packaging.
Right.
And so, you know, that's a company we're looking to support, to continue to grow, to consolidate that industry and build upon their environmental leadership, which we think is, you know, fundamental to what the company does. And that's why it's a non-concessionary investment. It looks a lot like any other investment Apollo would have made.
Right.
It just happens to be in a company that is focused on driving environmental
change. And you look at the same metrics, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because I do think that there's always like, okay, do we do a little bit of a trade-off in terms of performance or something? But I mean, Apollo, you guys are looking, you know, you're managing money for your investors, right? And there's going to be, you know, that exit point and you've got to make some money.
Absolutely.
The returns.
We're underwriting the exact same way that we see in like our large cap fund. With the added focus on what is the impact that company has, how do we measure it, how do we maximize that through our ownership period.
Mm-hmm.
But the concept that impact has to be concessionary, I think, comes in part from trying to shoehorn assets that don't have that kind of fundamental mutually reinforcing dynamic that a company in the circular economy has, where if they grow, earnings grow, they're also doing better for the world. If you're trying to be
they're having an impact in a positive way.
If you're trying to buy a company where profit and purpose are intention every day and do it in an impact portfolio, you're going to have to make that decision.
Joanna, are you ever doing any due diligence and you say to yourself, well, the numbers are there from where we think expected returns are going to be, but ESG just isn't. And as a result, we have to pass.
Absolutely.
That
happens with ESG across our platform where we find businesses with business practices we can't fix and we walk away. But for us, as we do that. And then we also do our impact diligence. And if we can't confirm to ourselves that there is a tangible, measurable positivity, either socially or environmentally from what the company does, we're not making that investment.
But what happens then, or do you leave it then to the venture capitalists, the angel investors? Because there are going to be those firms that will change the world. Look at an Elon Musk and Tesla, and for how long people are like, yeah, whatever, right? And here he is today, right? And if the investment money wasn't there to back it up, what a shame. So, but do you leave those companies that financially might not fit your criteria at Apollo and say, okay, there's plenty of other money at the venture angel stage, and then when it grows, we can jump in?
And the preponderance of capital focused on impact in private funds is focused on early stage businesses.
Yeah.
And there are people who are doing incredible work supporting, you know, hopefully the Teslas of the future.
Yeah.
That's just not us. And so we're looking to do impact, what we call it, impact at scale, later stage businesses, EBITDA and cash flow positive. But to widen that aperture away from thinking that the only company that can have impact is a newborn company that is so mission driven. You know, the company we just acquired was founded in 1967.
Which is great.
They didn't start out planning to improve the environment.
Right.
But that's where they are now.
Right.
Joanna, very briefly, do we get to a point within our lifetimes where ESG is no longer a thing because it's just everything adheres to ESG standards?
You know, that would be great. But I think where we are as a you know, human beings,
right,
is to constantly push for more.
Yeah.
And so if we can improve the employment practices of our businesses, we'll raise the standard.
Joanna Reese over at Apollo. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.